part-time fanboy.
Part-time fanboy doing my thing.
More powerful than a locomotive.
I'm not doing part.
Fanboy.com. How's it going, man?
It's going pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks again for carving out some time for me. I do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for carving out time for me. I appreciate it as well.
Very good. Well, we're mutually thankful, it sounds like. It
sounds like we're thankful for a lot, which is good. I thought you were in Florida with your Skype account, and I was like, oh my God, is he stuck in the aftermath of the hurricane? But it sounds like you're not. You're not there anymore.
No, but a lot of my friends were in the middle of it. And while I lived there for about 15 years, so I went through my fair share of hurricanes as well. But a couple of my buddies, like, they didn't have power for like 6 days. It was intense down there.
Oh, no. Are they okay?
Yeah, they're good. Like, it took them forever. Like, their power came back on, but then 2 days later, like, their internet finally came back. So I think they're just finally starting to function normally again.
Oh, my God. My mother was there in Orlando, but she's gotten out since then. So luckily... Okay. Everything's okay. So Florida's not Florida's okay, but everyone that we know in Florida is okay
yes.
right now.
Yeah, and that's where I lived was actually in Orlando too. So I mean, it was right in the middle of the thing.
Oh my gosh! All right. Well, for anyone listening, I'm actually on the line with Mr. Wes. It's Locher.
Locher, you got it, man.
Nailed it. All right. I have a really bad reputation. For mangling names on this podcast. So I nailed it. I'm very happy. Wes Locher, and you are the creator of, or the writer, right? And co-creator? Is that what I should say?
Writer and co-creator, correct.
Nice. Writer and co-creator of the Alterna Comics book, Unit 44. Is that how I should bill it? Is that correct?
You got it, man.
All right. So far, I'm on the right track. My name is Christian Horn, by the way, and this is obviously the Part-Time Fanboy podcast. And Wes, you are the first Alterna Comics creator I've had on the podcast.
All right.
Several weeks ago, I talked to Peter Cimetti, the publisher, the owner of Alterna Comics, and I was very intrigued by everything that he was doing. So I guess he sent out sort of like an email blast to some of you guys, and you were one of the first to be like, hey, can I come on your podcast? And I was like, of course you could come on my podcast. That's what it's for, to talk
Absolutely.
To, you know, comic creators and interesting people. So, I mean, I read the book, and I should say that I liked it very much. I think it's very a very fun book, really pretty, well illustrated, you know, lots of fun. It seems to me very much sort of inspired by like Men in Black, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And for the people that may be hearing about Unit 44 for the first time, the gist of the graphic novel, which is available now, is that inept Area 51 employees forget to pay the rent on their storage unit, and the secret contents are sold at public auction. So definitely type of a sort of a Men in Black type feel to it. You know, it's a buddy comedy. It's a comedy of errors. It's the type of story where, you know, things just keep getting worse and worse and worse. And our two main characters, who are Agent Gibson and Agent Hatch, they have to try to make it through not only alive, but while functioning as a team. And as our readers learn up front, they're a pretty dysfunctional couple.
Yeah, they definitely, they're sort of, I wouldn't say like the Abbott and Costello, but they definitely are not... you know, the most capable agents in probably that organization.
Absolutely. You have Agent Hatch, who's been working with the government for a while. He's a very stern, by the book, very capable agent who seems to have himself together. And then you have his counterpoint, which is Agent Gibson, and he's a little bit more of he's new to the job. He's a little bit of a slacker. His heart maybe isn't in it quite as much. So to see how they interact as they go through the adventure, to me, is part of the charm.
Yeah. It's really interesting because, you know, I was reading the book and it was funny. I was looking at the design and the two main characters, one of them, the sort of guy that reminds me of, what's his face, Ben Edlund from like The Tick and Seinfeld and stuff like that. He's very sort of like you know, straightforward design, but the other guy has anime hair.
Yes.
Manga hair. And so I was wondering, like, what was the sort of thought behind that sort of character design? Did you have any input to that? Or was that your artist, Eduardo Jimenez, who came up with that completely on his own?
Yeah, it was definitely Ed that designed the characters, and I wanted him to draw something that he was comfortable doing. But what I also look for when I start off a new comic book project, you know, one of the ground rules that I've always heard and have always tried to live by is that every character should be able to be recognized by their silhouette. So if you were to color them in completely black, you should still know who the characters are. So for us, giving Gibson that big blonde hairdo, that was a way to kind of say, well, he's not necessarily this guy in the suit that the other agent is. It was just a way to kind of juxtapose that maybe he's not this by the book guy, and he's not playing by the rules so much.
Yeah. It's a really very sort of a stereotypical anime 70s, 80s haircut. I love it. I think it's really great.
Definitely.
How did you sort of, I mean, I know it's kind of silly to ask the sort of stupid question, how did you sort of come up with the idea, but are you like a fan of like alien stuff, X-Files, that sort of thing?
Oh, totally. Yeah, I mean, I grew up with a fascination for the unexplained. At a really young age, I was into UFOs and Area 51, and this was even kind of pre-internet. So every year, like around my birthday or Christmas, my parents would always get me like, you know, untold stories of the UFOs or government conspiracies and that sort of thing. So I kind of grew up reading those by flashlight at my bed at night, and just kind of intrigued me a lot. And it was something that became very interesting to me. So I'd always kind of kept that in the back of my mind. Then after I started comics, I said, you know, I really want to do something that kind of has those elements in, but I didn't really know what type of story it was going to be. And so what actually brought the story together was that I was watching an episode of Storage Wars, which is a reality television show.
Yeah,
and for anybody who may not be familiar, just the rundown is that a couple of auctioneers, they auction off storage units that people bid on, kind of sight unseen. They don't really know what's inside, and they try to turn the contents for a profit. And so as I was watching this, I turned to my wife and I said, you know, what would happen if like one of these people bought a storage unit and inside was the answer to, you know, who killed Kennedy? You know, what if the microfilm was in there that told the whole story? And so like I kind of had this eureka moment where I was like, I can combine these two ideas, that the Area 51 aspect and the government conspiracy aspect of it. And immediately I turned the show off and I went into the other room and started writing in a notebook, just kind of the general idea. And it's funny too, because I have a good friend who I tend to run my ideas by, so he can either like thumbs up or thumbs down them. And he's kept me from making some very embarrassing mistakes in my time, but he actually thought this idea was horrible. And I think his words were, that will never work. So
really?
Very recently, I was able to give him a copy of the graphic novel and say, well, I told you so.
That's really funny, because that was the interesting thing that I mean, that's the thing that I found interesting about it. I didn't know anything about the book, you know, when you sent it to me, but I started reading it. And, you know, at first I'm like, OK, you know, Men in Black. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, these are completely incompetent agents, or seemingly so. Very much like in the Inspector Gadget sort of mold. I mean, obviously they're not robots and have gadgets, but you know, that sort of thing where they're sort of bumbling into their success a bit. But the other thing was the whole storage unit thing, and the two characters that actually purchased the storage unit. I thought a lot of that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was a highlight for me was getting to write the characters who purchased the storage unit. And they're kind of two, you know, backwoods rednecky types that aren't completely aware of what they've stumbled into. So as they're going through the contents of the unit and seeing all these crazy artifacts and weapons and corpses and things, they realize that they have something, you know, interesting in their hands. And then, of course, their first instinct is to sell it all on eBay. So before they can get around to that, the agents actually kind of come around and encounter them, and the chase is on, so to speak. And then events escalate from there, and some unforeseen things happen, and soon the contents are actually in the hands of somebody much more dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, the story goes downhill from there, or uphill, however you want. So are you still into that sort of like alien conspiracy theory stuff, or does that still like float your boat, or do you still read about that sort of thing?
Yeah, probably not as actively anymore, but some of my friends are very much into it. So once in a while, when talking with them, they'll, you know, run across the latest thing that they've heard about, and it's very interesting to hear what they're, you know, when it comes to things like, you know, climate change or the government with everything that's currently going on. They have lots of ideas and theories, so I like to entertain them. They don't necessarily, you know, I don't think I necessarily believe things as quite as easily as I did when I was a child, but I think my threshold for knowing when something is or isn't true is a lot better than it was when I was 8.
Sure.
But I still like to hear them. I still like to entertain them. It, you know, it's fun. It's as a writer, that's what you do. You have to be open to things and imagine things and be able to kind of reinterpret things. So any, you know, a story idea can come from anywhere. So I would be silly to close myself off to any source.
Sure, sure. It's really funny because the reason that I ask is because on Netflix recently, it seems like two documentaries kind of showed up about alien abductions or alien presence like on my feed, and I actually started watching them because my joke with my friends is that I'm more Scully than Mulder, you know. I'm like, you got to show me the evidence, I need to see everything, and I'm watching these things, and it's just reminding me of an old show, I don't know how old you are, like In Search Of, where I'm like, oh come on. You know, they're trying to present the evidence, and I'm like, you know, the eye roll starts to happen, and you know, I ended up turning it off. So I was just wondering how deep into that sort of thing you might be.
Well, to address that directly, they recently released on Netflix the Stan Romanek story.
I think that was one of them.
Yeah, and for anybody who may not be familiar, Stan Romanek is somebody who claims to have been abducted by aliens multiple times throughout his life, and
he's being followed.
He's essentially feels like he's being hunted by them, and has a lot of interesting evidence and photographic evidence and video evidence, and so yeah, I watched that one because I was familiar kind of with his story, and you know, it's interesting. You kind of get to take it all in and decide whether you believe or not. But I definitely recommend it for anybody that might be interested in extraterrestrial, or at least a very potentially convincing story and argument for them existing.
Or if you want a good laugh, because yeah, quite honestly, I couldn't take it. I started watching it, and they're like, there's all this video. And I'm like, that's a light in the sky. Come on. Like, I don't even, you know, whatever. I'm not going to get into it. But he believes what he believes. That's fine. And you should be open-minded. Yes.
Totally, totally. But he's also made a very lucrative career off of the story as well. So you can kind of take that for what it is. Absolutely.
Oh, really? Has he made like a lot of money or something?
Oh, yeah. He's an author. He's written a lot of books on the subject. He does a lot of speaking engagements. So his whole career is based off of these quote unquote experiences that he's had.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah. Wow. Talk about writing it all the way to the bank. I guess an alien anal probe is worth something.
Yeah. He's managed to spin that into to mailbox money. So good for him.
So you came up with this idea, you wrote it down in your notebook, and you started kind of moving forward. Now, did you know your artist offhand, or did you do a search, or like, were you friendly with him to start off with? How did you find your artist?
Sure. I know. I actually didn't know Ed prior to working on Unit 44. But typically when I start a new comic book project, I always kind of have an idea of the art style that I think that it should have. And sometimes I'm right and sometimes I'm wrong. But I, you know, just based off of the overall silliness and ridiculousness and irreverent humor that was going to be in the book, I had written pretty much the first issue script and knew the tone that I was going for and knew kind of what the message and how I wanted it to be received and the type of audience I wanted it to find. So I knew I needed like a, you know, Saturday morning cartoon type style, I think is kind of the best way to say it. So I just remember going on Twitter and was just kind of looking through artists. A lot of the artists I know are friends with other artists. So just kind of going through that deep Twitter network, I eventually somehow, and I still don't even really remember how I did it, but I ran across Ed's art, and I said, you know, I stopped and I just remember saying like, this is it. And he had some art that he'd done. I think it was like Street Fighter homage or something, but it looked really cool. Just the way that he did the faces, the poses that he had the characters in was very dynamic. And I said, you know, I think this might be a potential match. So I actually reached out to him through Twitter, sent him the first issue script and just said, hey, you know, I'm Wes, you've never heard of me, but I wrote this comic book that's really ridiculous, and I think you might be a good fit. You know, here's the script. Take a look when you have time. Let me know what you think. And then I didn't hear anything. Uh-huh. It was radio silence. So
that's
a very
trusting thing to do, to send your whole script to a complete stranger.
Well, you know, it is, but I guess the way that I look at it, there are a lot of people that worry about ideas being stolen, but the all of the creative people that I know, whether it's writers or artists, is they all have something, they all have a story that they're very passionate about that they typically don't, you know, they don't have time to steal someone else's ideas because they have five things that they'd want to be doing on their own. Sure. So maybe I'm too trusting, but I also feel like I know how their minds work. So yeah, but regardless, absolutely. I sent the script out to Ed, said, take a look. But then 2 to 3 days later, I actually got an email back from him. And not only had he read the script, and he's in Costa Rica, so he was behind me on the time zones a little bit. And so it was just kind of playing catch up. He not only said, hey, you know, I really like this and I really would be interested in being part of it, but he actually sent me back some rough sketches for Gibson and Hatch so I could kind of see what his interpretation would be. And they changed a little bit. The Gibson's hair got bigger. Hatch became a little bit less of a human tank. But they kind of retained their essence as we went through the development process. But, it, you know, it was great because I half expected to get an email back that says, like, you know, hey, how did you get this number? Don't ever get in touch with me again. Yeah. But he loved it. And it turns out, too, and I didn't know this until we were kind of midway through production, is that we actually have, like, a really similar sense of humor. So it turns out that, which is great, you know, you couldn't have really asked for much more when you are doing a humor book. And when you kind of look at the finished product, a lot of any dialogue gags were essentially mine, but then there's a lot of great stuff that Ed put into the background, visual gags, little creatures, you know, there's just, every page has so much stuff that you can just kind of digest from an art standpoint. And that was all him, you know, he really brought his flair to it. You know, he didn't ask me ahead of time, he just did it. And so what would happen is I would give him scripts that would make him laugh, and he in turn would give me back art that would make me laugh. So it was really just a fun production process. Definitely one of the smoothest, and just, I, you know, every day I was excited to refresh my inbox to see what he had sent that on that particular day.
Oh, that's awesome. Is he working digitally primarily? I mean, it looks like a lot of the brush strokes and lines and stuff like that are, you know, and this is not, you know, insulting in any way, like in an insulting way, but very uniform, steady line work. Is he, what is he working in? Do you know?
Yeah, he is 100% digital. So he not only penciled, inked the book, he also colored it as well. So he's able to just set his stuff up the way that he wants to. And what's really funny is that originally we had taken the project to Kickstarter.
Oh, really?
And this was back in 2014, 2015. We funded the first issue with the help of some nice backers there. And it was kind of, we didn't have a publisher attached at that point. It was just this book that we wanted to make. And so we funded it, we made the first issue, sent it out to everybody, and then we started pitching it around to publishers. And the consensus that we got from everywhere that we sent it was, like, we really like it, it's really funny, but humor's kind of hard sell for us. We're not really sure that we want to go that direction right now, so we're going to pass. So it was like the nice kick in the pants on the way out the door. So, but we were having so much fun with it. We said, well, we should just finish the series. We had all these people that bought the first issue that essentially pre-ordered it through Kickstarter. We got a lot of great feedback, people saying, when's the next one coming out? You know, what is there more? Is this it? You left us on a cliffhanger. What's going on? So we then went back to Kickstarter and we decided to fund the remaining three issues. And then what happened is it was about 3 days before I was about to launch the Kickstarter campaign. I got an email from Peter Cimetti over at Alterna. And he was like, oh, hey, what's going on, man? Well, you have that crazy Area 51 book. What's your plan with that? I'm interested. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this kind of changes things a little bit. Now, I'd been a fan of Alterna. Like, they have a lot of really interesting titles in their archives, so I was familiar with them. I owned a lot of their books. I was kind of a fan of what they were doing. So for Ed and I, it was very easy to say, well, yeah, I mean, this guy's enthusiastic about our project. We'd be crazy to say no. You know, his contract is very fair to creators. He only publishes things that he likes. So to us, that was very comforting because we knew that if he was willing to get behind it, he was going to promote it as well. He wasn't going to just leave us out to dry. And he's done a fantastic job with that. So once we had the backing of Alterna, we kind of relaunched our campaign and were able to use that to get a little bit more buzz around it. And so we successfully kickstarted the remaining issues. But then what happened, and this is going back to a testament to Ed, I remember he sends me an email one day and he says, hey, you know, I think, you know, now that I've drawn this entire series, because by this point he's produced 88 pages, he knows these characters inside and out. He's like, I think I want to make some changes to the first issue. And I said, well, you know, that's fine. You know, we still have time. We don't have to get this thing out tomorrow. You know, do what you want to do. And I remember it was like a week later Ed writes me back and he says, okay, here's the new pages. And what he had done in that week is he had, from the ground up, redrawn and recolored the entirety of issue one to make it more uniform with the rest of the series. And it was fantastic. So out there now, there are people that have the original thing that we released via Kickstarter, and then we released this new issue. So that actually helped kind of bring readers back into the fold as well, and ended up being a pretty good tool for us. So Ed's fantastic. He's amazing. He's got like just one of the best work ethics I've ever seen in an artist. And when he says he's going to do something, he's going to do it to the best of his ability.
Wow. Sounds like it. I mean, wow. To redraw the whole first issue, like within a week. I mean, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. And it didn't look rushed in any way, shape or form. I mean,
no, it doesn't.
He took his art to the next level in the process. So I was super proud of him for that.
So wait, do you know what program he's using? Is he just Photoshop or is it Illustrator?
I don't know. It may be like Manga Studio.
It does look like Manga Studio to me a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know the artistic process. I know that he uses like a Wacom tablet, draws directly onto the screen.
Wow, so there's no original pages for you to like have and be anything like that. Oh, wow. No,
he's produced art for the book. We did some posters for the Kickstarter that we did for the graphic novel. So I created prints of those and I have them hanging in my office. But no, unfortunately, I won't ever own any original Unit 44 pages, which is sad, but kind of cool at the same time.
Yeah. No, that is, it's really cool. It's an interesting way to do things. And a lot of people are doing it that way these days. I guess what I'm sort of like really, so you said you did one Kickstarter, you did a first issue, and was the plan to always just do four, or were you going to, was the plan to do a graphic novel initially, and then you were going to break it up? And then I guess my other question is, you were just about to launch the Kickstarter and you sort of got interest from Alterna. So you still went ahead with the Kickstarter anyway? I mean, was that for like extra funding, or does Alterna pay the publishing costs? I guess, like, how does that work out?
Sure. I got you. So the Kickstarter is essentially what they would let us do is that, the money went to Ed so that he could focus full time on that project as a freelance artist.
Oh, nice.
So all of the funding that we got for all of those issues just kept him, basically made sure that he could focus his time on that without having to worry about take on other work and push the deadline back that we'd kind of set for ourselves.
Smart.
So once we had finished those four issues, what we did is we debuted them serialized through Comixology, and that was with Alterna. So they originally, the four issues came out in 2015, near the end of the year. And then it came down to, we knew that we wanted to do a graphic novel. We just didn't have the funding immediately. So then Alterna actually launched their newsprint line within the last, you know, couple of 6 months, a year at this point. And we had the choice. We could either re-release the series as those newsprint issues, or we could choose to do it as a collected graphic novel that would be really nice and look good on a shelf and that type of thing. And we felt that since we had already done the issues, we should probably just do the graphic novel. Not only is it something that we selfishly wanted on our bookshelves, but we also thought that the story would read really well in that format. It's, you know, if you take out the issue breaks, it doesn't affect the story too much. So I'm extremely happy with the choice that we made, and to be able to go to stores in my area, especially, and actually see it on the rack has been, you know, super exciting for me as a comic creator. I've had a couple of other graphic novels in stores, but this is the one that feels like people actually ordered it, and people are sending me photos of it, you know, in New York City and in Texas, and just to see it in their personal stores has been really cool.
Yeah, that's really amazing. That sounds like a really good plan. So when you did your first four, they were not doing the newsprint sort of thing. So
correct.
So your initial issues were like what, like glossy paper, or like the typical comic book sort of paper?
No, when we actually never did physical single issues except for what we would print for conventions, which was just kind of like a print on demand. When we joined Alterna, they were strictly publishing graphic novels only. They were doing digital issues through Comixology, but there were no print issues at that point. That's only something that's come in with the newsprint line. So that wasn't even an option first when we started the crazy journey.
Oh, so you went first from like, say, your first Kickstarter issue, and then you went straight to sort of like a graphic novel.
Yes. So we did another Kickstarter this year, which funded the actual graphic novel. Since as creators, we have to fund the print cost up front. That allowed us to print all the copies that we needed to fulfill the orders from Diamond, so we could get it into comic shops, we could get it into bookstores, and people would be able to order it from Amazon, Target, you know, all the usual suspects.
Sure. Oh, that's interesting, because I guess my understanding was that Alterna would pay for the publishing costs, and then whatever profits were left over were sort of divided between the creators and Alterna. Are you saying that you had to sort of pay your own publishing costs? I mean, your printing costs?
Correct. And that's pretty standard with, you know, even image creators essentially do that as well. The system that we went through isn't anything different that I haven't had to do with another publisher as well.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah, I'm back on board. I get it. So you avoided the newsprint thing completely.
Correct. Yeah, and that was just, again, we had the choice to do this way or that way, and the way that we chose was just to do the graphic novel. And the other reason behind that, too, is that, you know, having lived with the series and having had it release once already, we kind of wanted to get it out there and see what the response was in case we had the potential to do more, I guess would be kind of how to say it. Yeah. So far the response has been good. People aren't blowing up my email inbox asking for a sequel by any means, but we know that that's an option that's on the table.
Sure. It's really interesting because one of the biggest things that's intrigued me about Alterna is the sort of newsprint style. And when I did the interview with Peter Cimetti, I had not seen any of the books. And when I got them, finally picked some up, it was really like culture shock, like holding this newsprint thing. And I was just like, oh my God. Like, I mean, it's funny because the quality of the books, you know, varies between sort of like titles, but it's just like really weird. It's amazing how much we've become accustomed to this new sort of like really nice paper, really nice, because there was a part of me that was like, oh wow. And you know, not to besmirch Alterna in any way, but there I did pull out some like older like Marvel books from like the 80s, and even Alterna's sort of like newsprint print quality was a little bit sort of like less than what you would have expected from back in the day. So it was just like really, which didn't ruin the reading experience or anything, but it was very sort of like, oh wow, like this is different. It was kind of like culture shock. So you avoided that whole, you know, because I mean, some people that I go to, that I've gone to online, you know, other people that collect comics or other people that are, you know, writers or whatever, and that I showed the initial interview to, were like, oh yeah, that's not going to work out. No, nobody wants that. That's just, and I was like, really? Wow. People were so close-minded. So you didn't have to really fight any sort of like uphill battle in those terms.
No. And you know, I've seen the newsprint issues and they've carried them at my local store. And it's interesting because part of it, yeah, it's kind of a gimmick, but then again, if you just found the book on the shelf and you didn't know anything about it being a newsprint title, you know, you would pick it up because the cover art is, you know, fantastic and it looks like an interesting story. And then I think by the time you actually realize that you're reading a newsprint comic, you know, you're done with the issue and you've enjoyed it. But from a publishing standpoint, what they're doing is really smart because it's allowing them to print a large quantity of an indie book at a very low cost.
Sure.
And so it's allowing them to then get their, you know, this was a publisher who a year ago wasn't doing single issues at all. So they have found a very smart avenue that allows them to get their single issues into stores and compete alongside Marvel, DC, Image, Boom. You know, sure, the quality itself might be different, but just to have that shelf space is very important when you're kind of building your brand. So I think that what they've done is a really smart thing, and I hope people don't see it as a gimmick, because it should be about the comic book itself. You know, don't not read it because it's newsprint. Don't read it if you don't like the story.
Yeah, no, and I don't disagree with that at all. I mean, that's the thing is, I mean, I've been really shocked by people who've been like, oh, nobody wants newsprint. I mean, I don't think it's that people see it as a gimmick. I think that people just see it like, and you know, and then there's all these excuses. Oh, you know, the price isn't high enough for store owners to make enough of a profit on. And I'm just like, like all your arguments really make no sense, because if you're selling a book for like $1.50, you're going to sell more of that book,
exactly.
You know, and that'll make up, you know, sort of like the margin that you would lose on like a $4, $5, $6 book that maybe nobody will buy because of the initial price.
Sure. And you know, what I saw too is that when I was promoting Unit 44, when it was in previews, I went, you know, I drove to all the comic shops kind of in my region here within like hour, 2 hour distance. And what I found out was that, you know, telling them about Unit 44, they hadn't heard of it, of course, but that also led to conversation about the newsprint comics. And what I learned was that a lot of the retailers had heard about it, but they weren't completely like sold. So it gave me an opportunity to kind of represent the company and say, you know, you should really consider checking them out, you know, because not only is it going to be a very cheap option for your customers, you know, it's actually really quality books, you know, I know a lot of alternate creators. So occasionally I get to see issues before they actually come out, and I felt comfortable being able to kind of back them up. And the really cool thing is that I actually had a few shops that emailed me after I visited, and they said, not only did we order, you know, 5 copies, 10 copies of your book, we actually ordered all of the newsprint titles as well. So I felt like it was mutually beneficial for everybody in that alternate family.
That's great. You're sort of like the bearer of the banner, right?
Well, you have to be. You know, I would hope that anybody that's out there with the title at Alterna is doing the same thing. You know, I sing their praises. I tell people about the comics that I like coming out from that company, and I would hope that they do the exact same thing when they're doing signings or when they're interfacing with their retailers.
Yeah. So you had mentioned earlier, I mean, you've said a couple of times, whenever I start a new comic project, what are some of your other projects? Because you know, pardon my ignorance, but I have maybe not heard of your name before. And now
that's
I'm worried,
right,
that I'm speaking to some big shot comic creator. And I'm like wholly ignorant. I mean, obviously I'm not I don't read pamphlets. I'm not all caught up on like whatever Civil War II or whatever's happening,
no worries,
wherever. You know, I read trades, and I tend to get stuff like either on Amazon or on sale at the comic shop.
Sure.
I've done whole episodes about that. But what else have you worked on before this?
Totally. I've got a pretty extensive back catalog, and just to kind of touch on what you said, I'm with
now
you.
I feel
like
terrible.
It's cool. It's cool, and I'll kind of get to why maybe you haven't heard about it. But much like you, like I don't read everything that's on the shelf every month, and I tend to steer away from like the Marvel and DC titles more and more. So I tend to read like a lot of weird stuff, a lot of indie stuff. Like my friends will send me things, or they'll send me what they're working on, and that's this type of things I really enjoy. I grew up on kind of outside the box stuff. Like I grew up on comics like The Tick and, you know, Scud the Disposable Assassin, and these really, yes, weird kind of niche things that have influenced me. I've worked with a couple other publishers in the past. I did in 2013, my very first graphic novel came out with a company called Arcana Studios, and that was a 4-issue series called Chambers, which is kind of a crime thriller. And I worked on that with the artist Christian Rossi, who actually draws the book Trespasser at Alterna now. So we kind of have a cool history together. And then the next year, I released a graphic novel with a company called Marcosia Enterprises out of the UK. And that was a graphic novel called The Undoubtables, which is kind of a heist story. So very much Ocean's 11 type feel to it. And then beyond that, I've self-published a lot of one-shots. I have a time travel comic called The Temporal. I have a really wacky post-apocalyptic tale called Hipsters versus Rednecks. I just recently launched a new series, self-published, which is about the inventor Thomas Edison. It's called Edison, but it envisions him as an action hero in the 1880s. So it's a little bit James Bond, a little bit MacGyver, but he uses science to defeat his genius enemies. So I tend to do things that are just a little bit kind of outside of the box.
Oh, wow. That sounds like a lot of work. I mean, that sounds like a lot of stuff that you've done, but it seems like you've stuck mostly sort of like to doing independent books.
Yeah.
Or indie books.
Yeah, I definitely like to, you know, I don't try to emulate anything that I see. I think that maybe the crime book that I did early on in my career was me trying to, you know, kind of find something similar to what like Ed Brubaker would do. You know, he was somebody that I was reading a lot of at the time, and I wanted to try my hand on it. And, you know, I'm happy with how that series came together, but you know, I part of me never quite felt like it was my voice. It felt like it was me maybe trying to emulate somebody else. So I kind of made, after going through that process and spending all the time and money associated with it, you know, I said, you know, I need to do things that are interesting for me. I need to be writing those things that nobody else can write. So, you know, that definitely led to Hipsters versus Rednecks, Unit 44, these really silly ideas. Things that I do now tend to have more of a humorous bent to them. I find that people are being more receptive to humor, even though it's subjective. People seem to be looking for more of an escape nowadays. I see people that seem to get kind of weary with, you know, street level gritty stories. You can turn on the news and see that. And I find when I go to conventions and can actually talk to people face to face, you know, if I give them the one liner for Unit 44, it makes them laugh. And I can say, well, you know, you laughed at one sentence. Now imagine 88 pages of that. And it seems, it's just very easy to kind of relate to people on that level and say, you know, you're looking for a way out of the crazy world for half an hour. You know, here's your ticket.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really good way to sort of sell it. I mean, because, yeah, I mean, like I said, when I first opened the book, I was like, oh, this is a great idea. I'm wondering how far you can sort of take this as far as the storage unit goes. And then you sort of expand it into a very interesting sort of alien invasion story that, you know, hope I'm not spoiling anything.
No.
That sort of kind of, it does come out a little bit out of left field.
Yeah, you know, I think you get people in with the kernel of the idea, and then you kind of have to blow the world open a bit and say it's more than just storage units in Area 51. It's, there was something in that storage unit that's going to prevent an alien invasion, and if these agents want to save the world, they have to get it back. That adds a whole new, that raises the stakes and gives you, you know, gives the characters a reason to get from point A to point B.
Sure, sure. And what are some of, I mean, you mentioned Ed Brubaker. What are some of, what got you into comics in the first place? Do you remember? Who are some of your big influences? I mean, obviously there must be some anime in there because of this guy's hair.
You know, honestly, I have zero experience with anime. I think
really?
That's more Ed's kind
wait,
of...
Wait. You've never seen like Cowboy Bebop or anything?
You know,
like
that is, I would say that's the only anime I've ever seen. I didn't even know if that counted as anime, but that's all I've seen is that. So any other things that, you know, may seem similar, I don't know. So mostly because, nothing against it, I think, you know, you should watch what you find interesting and inspiring. Mostly it comes just down to time for me. I can invest
sure,
in
that. Sure, that's a really political way of saying, like, it's just not for me.
it's just not for me. I know what sure. I like, but I don't look down on it. I don't have anything against
sure,
it.
Sure,
I just don't
I
think it's for me.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
All good. But, you know, it's back to books that inspired me. I think it goes back to what I said earlier. You know, Bed Edlund's The Tick was huge for me. Not only the comic book, but then the cartoon, which was on when I was a little bit younger. And then, you know, Scud the Disposable Assassin was a book that came out that was black and white. It was insane. It was crazy. It had a really weird concept. It was this very hyperkinetic art style. They made jokes unapologetically, a lot of pop culture references, just things like that resonated with me because it felt very of the times. And it felt very socially conscious of kind of things that were going on. So, you know, I definitely like to put a lot of jokes in my comics, but I also like to, you know, try to wrap them up with a story that has good characters and that has something that people will kind of think about once they've closed the back cover of the book.
Sure, sure. Oh, that's really great. You know, I don't know what, you know, working ethic. I can't think of the phrase, but I mean, that's interesting that, you know, it seems like you were sort of exposed to indie sort of at a younger age more than the rest of us were, because I know that, or like your sort of typical average comic fan, because I know that for me and a lot of my friends or people that I know, it's always like Marvel and DC, but you're talking about The Tick and Scud the Disposable, like where would you have discovered Scud the Disposable Assassin at a young age?
Right. Luckily, the comic book shop that I went to growing up, I developed a really good relationship with the folks who worked there. And you know, this is back before you realize, you know, when you're a kid, you don't realize like that people really write these comics and you don't like, you don't even know how often they come out. Like I would go into the comic book shop like 3 times a week and be like, hey, how come you don't have anything new, you know? And it just kind of, you know, being oblivious to that aspect of it. But what would happen is that because I was going in there so much, like it was just in downtown in the city that I lived in. And, you know, my mom would just drop me off there while she ran, like went to the grocery store and went to the library and all that stuff. So I would just hang out in there and like got to be really friendly with the people. So I think it was probably like in an effort to get me to buy more stuff, because they already knew that I'd bought Spider-Man and Daredevil that week. They just started showing me like these really random things that they would order that they like. So it was like, you know, hey, Wes, come over here and check out this thing I have, you know, called The Tick. It's new. And, you know, I think you might like it because, you know, you like funny stuff. And it was just them kind of, you know, just putting stuff in my hands and saying, here, just give this a shot. You know, and they, and I remember, too, they would like give me stuff for free. They would say, like, you know, if you don't like this, like, just bring it back next week. No big deal. So it was just being able to just sample stuff. And at that point, you know, I didn't have in my brain, I didn't have like, oh, Marvel and DC are the top and everything else is subpar to it. Like the way that I came up was just that comic books were comic books, and they were comic books about everything. So I guess in my brain, I never had a differentiator to know that like Marvel was supposed to be in quality higher than The Tick, for instance. So I never had to like, you know, say, oh, I'm not going to read an indie book because it's, you know, it's not colored right and it looks like crap. It's black and white. That was just not something that I thought about.
That's really interesting because, I mean, from my, you know, my growing up, it was definitely sort of the other way around. I mean, there weren't a lot of like, say, indie. I mean, there were indie books when I was growing up, but I wasn't really, it takes, you come around the other way. It's like Marvel and DC. And then it's like, oh, how many times can Dr. Octopus punch Spider-Man?
Absolutely.
You know, then you start discovering the sort of indie thing. It's interesting to me that you were exposed to sort of the indie ethos, you know, early on.
Yeah, and even like a lot of my friends were into comic books at the same time, and they were only into, you know, Marvel and DC. Like my best friend, he would only read Thor comics. Like that's all he would read. To him, anything that wasn't Thor was, you know, was stupid and subpar and, you know, sure, didn't need to be created. So it was like, I just could
was
never
it
understand.
Simonson's Thor? Because then he's correct. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't remember this. It's probably back in like 93, 94, 95, somewhere in there. Sure. You know, but it killed me because I wanted to share with them all these other really cool books. And it was also right around the time that the Image first came out. So there were all these like really, you know, horribly drawn Liefeld books hitting the shelves that were still cool at the time. But, you know, so there was just a lot. It felt like there was like an explosion of creativity. So it was like, to me, I couldn't understand why people wouldn't, you know, just try everything. Because comics still, they weren't that expensive back then. I mean, they were still under $2 at that point. So your money went bit further. You know, so as long as the budget wasn't an issue, it was like I would just, if I knew I had $20 to spend, I would buy $20 worth of comics, and whatever that would get me, I would pore over and read and reread until the covers fell off.
Sure. Oh wow, that's, yeah, I mean, it's so funny to me because, like I said, I came around the other way, and it seems like most of the stuff that you've done when you were kind of going down the list of your credits is very creator owned or mm-hmm. It's like your own. I mean, it seems like maybe one or two things in there were done for a publisher, for somebody else, but it seems like you have really embraced that sort of creator owned ethic.
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think that, you know, despite where you want to get in your comics career, you know, you want readers to follow you because they know that you're going to bring a certain quality of story to them. And I, you know, I guess I would want people who enjoy my books to know that they're going to get something that's going to be a little bit ridiculous, a little bit irreverent, but is going to be a good story. You know, some of my writer friends now, they once in a while, they'll talk about like, oh, you know, if you could write any Marvel title, what would you want to write? And it's like, I never have an answer to that question. Like, even though I love Spider-Man and he's one of my favorite characters ever, it's like, I don't have a Spider-Man story just like waiting to be told. I would rather write about hipsters and rednecks battling for the fate of the world. That just sounds so much more appealing to me. So it's uh-huh. It's interesting that, you know, if Marvel called me tomorrow and said, what title are you going to write for us, Wes? I'd be like, I'm going to have to call you back, man.
Don't say that. Say, like, I'm going to write Spider-Man, and this is what I want to write. Yeah, although I think Dan Slott has that job wrapped up for like the next 50 years.
Seems to be in good hands, so let him do his thing, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So where are you pulling sort of like your ideas from? I mean, it sounds like, you know, the idea for Unit 44 came from something that you saw on TV. Is it just like everything around you? Are you reading? Are you constantly looking for ideas? And what some sort of advice that you could give for comic writers who, you know, are sort of trying to do their own thing or get discovered?
Sure. I mean, I think the best advice is just to be open to everything. You know, whether that's like a, you know, if your friend needs to vent about how much he hates his job, like listen to that, because there's going to be something in there that you might be able to use one day, whether it's the concept for a series or even, you know, a character or even a particular emotion that may need to come through in a scene at some point. But as far as where I get my ideas, like, it's so random. Like a lot of them just hit me. Like I'll be driving or I'll be in the shower and I'll be thinking about something completely unrelated, or I'll, you know, have somebody that's walking by in the store and they'll say something that I combine with something else. And, you know, when I look back on a lot of my books, I honestly can't remember what happened, like what actually came together to make the idea. Usually it's just stuff that, like, if I think about it and it makes me laugh, it's worth pursuing. It's worth jotting down in a notebook, and I may not use it for 3 years, but it's there and I can open it up and look at it with fresh eyes another time and say, oh, I actually know what that story is now. So it's just a matter of kind of farming the little kernels and keeping them handy. So when they need to be pulled out, they're always at arm's length.
Nice. And are you the type of writer that sort of like keeps a notebook with him and like is jotting things down at all times?
All the time. I have on my desk right now, I have, I'm looking at 5 notebooks that are in various states of disarray.
That's great. Do you doodle too? Are you drawing and like drawing ideas all the time and stuff?
No, I have zero artistic talent.
Not even stick figures? You're not like this guy?
I wouldn't know what they were if I went back to them. Like I would draw them and then it would just look like chaos to me. So I leave that to all my really talented friends and I just try to paint them a really powerful picture within the script so that they can draw it 10 times better than I could. But, you know, I would love, somehow my sister is a fantastic artist. She does art professionally, but somehow that just totally skipped me in the gene pool. Mm-hmm. So I got the writing, she got the art.
That's funny. That's it's kind of the way it goes. Genetic yep. Split. So what is some of the stuff you're a current reader of comics, I would imagine. Is there anything that you're reading currently that you're enjoying or?
Yeah, I'm a little bit behind. Like, I typically what I'll do is I read mainly digitally. For a while, I lived in an area where I didn't have access to a comic book shop, so I just started reading digitally and have
you're
since
one
kind
of those.
Of doing. Yeah, I do that, but it's okay because if you're like 6 months behind, then you actually get a pretty good deal on the comics, and your money goes a little bit further, and you can read a little bit more. So I'm okay with that. I don't have anybody that, like, you know, every Wednesday we're getting on the phone and talking about the comics, so I don't have to keep up on the conversation. So sure. I just kind of read at my leisure. But there's a lot of great stuff that I've checked out recently. There's a writer, his name is Ryan Ferrier, and he's done a lot of fantastic work. He did the series Dave for IDW. He also did Dave 2, Daveocracy, which finished off the trilogy, which is a super funny series that I highly recommend people check out if they enjoy laughing. Check out all of his work. He's just a fantastic writer, and he's doing a lot of work for like Boom Studios. He just was announced as the writer for the Rocko's Modern Life comic coming out from Boom in the near future.
Oh, wow.
So that's somebody to watch, somebody that has a lot of really good ideas and has a fantastic sense of humor. I really like, you know, a lot of the mainstays too. Like, I think Brian K. Vaughan is one of my favorite comic book writers. I think his stories are fantastic. You know, sure. I keep up with Saga as best I can now, but I also really like his old series. You know, Ex Machina from back in the early 2000s is just a wonderful piece of fiction. Why the Last Man is phenomenal. Yes. If I ever need to remind myself on the craft of writing a comic book, I can crack open one of his comics, and each one is like a clinic on kind of how to structure, how to pace, how to pull out that gut-wrenching surprise twist ending. I mean, there's just so much that can be learned. I mean, there's a reason that this guy wins the Eisner Award every year, it feels like.
Sure. Oh, wow, that's great. So Unit 44 came out in August, correct? Early August?
Yeah, it debuted on August 9th.
Yeah, that's so funny. It took us so long to get to this. I can't even believe it.
I've been talking about it nonstop, so to me, it still feels like yesterday.
That's great. And so, do you have ideas for a sequel? I mean, were you thinking of a sequel? Or, Are you waiting for sales figures to come in? Like, how, what are you thinking as far as the future of Unit 44?
Yeah, we're definitely, we're waiting. Ed and I have hashed it out. We know what the sequel would be if at any point it gets requested or if we decide to pursue that. I actually have the first script of the next miniseries written. We just haven't had the chance to actually put it into production yet. But beyond that, too, is that once we finished up Unit 44, and because Ed had drawn the series and then redrawn that first issue, he was a little bit kind of tired of doing those characters. I think he needed a little bit of a break. Sure. He came back and he actually did a four-issue short that's in the very back of the graphic novel, which was a ton of fun. It was a nice way to revisit the characters essentially a year and a half after we finished the main series. But what happened was is that we actually then went on and developed another comic book series entirely. That I can kind of mention it. It's not out yet. It's under consideration with a publisher right now. So I'm hoping that within the next few weeks, we're going to get some good news and be able to kind of ramp up on it. But the series is, it's a fantasy comedy. So it's like a sword and sorcery type setting. The nice. Title of the book is called Chaotic Good. And the gist is that in a fantasy world, an evil sorcerer attacks the lands, and a young pair of twins attempt to resurrect history's greatest warrior to defeat him. But in the process, they accidentally resurrect the hero's slacker brother instead.
Nice.
So that is that is the series that we're currently pitching around, and I hope that we'll have some really good news to share about it soon.
That's great. So you can't just say take that idea and go to alternate and say, hey, man, we've done stuff together before. Let's do this again. Or is it just you're looking to see what your options are?
Yeah, we definitely want to explore our options. I love Peter and Alternate to death, and I feel confident that he would publish it, you know, if we asked him. And I don't want to sound I don't have any type of ego about it, but I think that we have a good relationship and he would be interested. But I was actually invited to in the event that I had something for a particular publisher, I was invited to kind of submit to them. And so I wanted to, just for my own career and Ed's career, kind of take that opportunity to see what might happen with that. So not to diss on Alternate in any way, shape, or form, but I just thought it might be cool to see, you know, what another experience could potentially be like.
Sure, sure. Oh, that's great. That's great. Are you doing any appearances in the near future? Any signings? Any conventions that anyone should know about?
Yeah, I will be. I am located in Ohio. So for people that are in the area, I will be doing a signing on October 28th at a store called Comics, Cards, and Collectibles, which is located in Canton, Ohio. So nice. There's a kind of a Halloween festival. A lot of local artists and writers are coming in to set up shop and sell their stuff. So I will be there slinging copies of Unit 44 and all those other crazy books that I mentioned.
That's great. That's awesome. Well, I'm so glad that you came on to this podcast. I really do appreciate your time. Are there any other sort of projects, irons in the fire, that you want to talk about, or any other ideas that you want to throw out there into the internet?
Sure. I mean, I have a lot of, like I said, a lot of really talented friends that I've been developing projects with. My goal as a creator is I try to put out a mini series each year, or at least some sort of comic, just to kind of make sure that I maintain whatever relevancy I can at this point. So I have another series that I've been working on for the past year, which is called Awry, drawn by artist Graham Jarvis. And that's kind of a dark comedy sci-fi tale. We're going into production on the fourth and final issue probably within the month here. And we haven't pitched it to anybody. We haven't even really told anybody that it exists. It's something that he and I are the only two people working on it. It's something we wanted to kind of make for ourselves with full creative control. Now you do. So I'm hoping that
it's only between you and me now.
Nobody else will ever know. But I'm really excited. It's Graham's first comic book. He's a younger artist, but his work is really, really like advanced beyond his years as a human. And it's really impressive, and I can't wait for people to see it. So we kind of decided, like, hey, let's just do this the way that we want to do it, and then we'll potentially see if anybody is interested in putting it out. And if it's not, then we'll just release it ourselves. So we just wanted to make sure that we did something that was true to us, and I think that this was the best way to go about it.
That's great. And you're thinking that's coming out in 2018?
I would hope so. One way or another, I feel like that's probably a safe bet.
Are you going to kickstart it?
I don't know if we have to, we may.
Gotcha.
We haven't really talked a whole lot about that. We're just kind of very focused on like, hey, let's just get this done and let's worry about it, the other stuff later. Because what typically happens is a lot of times when you pitch a book to a publisher, you're really only pitching them like, 5, 8, 10, 12 pages. You don't have the series done at this point. So then you get the green light to go ahead. And the first question that they ask you is, well, when is this going to be done? When are you going to draw the other 90 pages? And it's like, I don't know,
it's
the artist works and the colorist works. And so this way we wanted to be able to take a project and say like, hey, not only is, here's our idea, but this is actually, you could begin publishing this next month if you wanted to, which I'd be curious to see if that gives us any type of edge.
Oh, wow. That's great. That's great. That sounds great. I mean, and where can people find you online and stuff?
They can just head over to my website, which is just Wes Locher, L-O-C-H-E-R. It's all one word. There's links to all of my comic books work, all of the other, I've done a lot of writing in for various industries and companies and such, so they can learn a little bit more about me there. And they can find the social networks as well. And by day, I actually do writing for video games. So typically there's some crossover and audience there. So if you like video games, you can see the games that I've written there and see if there's something that might interest you.
That's awesome. Well, wow. Great. That's I'm so glad that we were able to touch base and do this interview. I really did enjoy Unit 44. I think it's a really fun book. I enjoyed everything about it. It's very lighthearted, very fun, friendly, family friendly too. It's not, I don't know that I would say it's particularly all ages, but it's definitely, something that sort of younger readers would enjoy too.
Yeah, we say about like, probably suitable for kids that are at least 12 or so. There's no swearing in the book. Everything is censored out that could be potentially, offensive, I guess. Some of the jokes may go over a kid's head, but for the most part, I think that, as long as you have a mature kid that or a mature teen that can handle some, funny adult crude humor, then you'll be in good company.
Yeah. Well, in any case, I think it's a really fun book. I enjoyed it. I'm glad that you introduced me to it. And, definitely give me a heads up of any future projects. Maybe you could come back on the podcast or whatever,
sure.
Because I really like this. Well, I like this. I haven't seen any other stuff, but everything else sounds really interesting. So, I'm definitely going to check you out online, next. So, and look into your other stuff. But thank you so much for thinking of me. And thank you so much for coming onto the Part-Time Fanboy podcast.
Yeah, man, it's my pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me a forum to chat about the book and to sing the praises of not only Alterna and Peter and everything that they've done, but also a chance to say some kind words about Ed Jimenez, who just, like I said, a wonderful artist, just turned out to be a wonderful human who I absolutely adore and can't wait to keep working with.
Yeah, I should definitely say that I really enjoyed his art on this book. I mean, it fits the title completely, and I just thought that there was definitely a lot of skill, that shone through on the, on my tablet page. But you know what I'm saying? I think it's some really fun, interesting, and the only other term that I can use is that it's, it's very brightly colored. I mean, like you said, Saturday morning cartoon, but that sort of term does have a stigma about it. I think it's better than that. So I think that he is a really solid artist, and I can't wait to see more from him.
Absolutely. You and me both, man. Every time that he works on a new project, I'm always the first in line to check it out. So whether it's working with me or working with some other talented writers as he has in the past, he's definitely somebody that you should be watching.
Definitely, definitely. Well, Wes Locher, I really appreciate you coming on, and hopefully we will see more or hear more of you in the future. I can't wait to see what your other projects are. Everyone should go to wesloker.com, correct?
You got it. Yeah.
All right, and check out this gentleman's work. Definitely look for Unit 44. They can find it in comic shops, right, through Diamond?
What's
the order code?
The order code, if you say something to fill time, I can get it and tell it to you.
I can edit.
Okay, very good. You walk in there and you say, hey, give me Unit 44, and they'll make it happen. But the actual order code, if you would like to make your retailer's life easy and take it to them, is JUN171148. So write that on a slip of paper and toss it to your retailer, and they can have you the book within a week.
Awesome. Terrific. Well, I love the book, and thank you so much for coming on to the podcast. My name is Christian Horn. This has been another episode of the Part-Time Fanboy Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all that wonderful stuff. And as always, we are at parttimefanboy.com. Thank you for listening, and we will be back soon with another episode. Bye.
Part-Time Fanboy.